supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. One of the 12 jurors in the sexual assault trial of Bill Cosby says he's disappointed the panel couldn't reach a unanimous verdict, but he says he's glad prosecutors will be putting Cosby on trial again. WHYY's Bobby Allen spoke to the juror 1 week after the judge in the Cosby case declared a mistrial.
Cosby juror Bobby Dugan is a 21-year-old from Pittsburgh. He says before the trial, he had heard of other accusations against the entertainer, but he hadn't made any judgments about whether Cosby was guilty.
2 years ago, I heard something about it, but I thought it was all said and done when I was called in. So it was kind of a shock.
But when Dugan heard what Cosby said in a 2005 deposition, he was convinced.
When he said it, you know, himself, he was asked, would you use the word consent? And he said, I wouldn't use that word.
In the deposition, Cosby said he went, quote, somewhere between permission and rejection, and that Cosby never verbally asked Constant for consent.
And in my opinion, consent is a verbal agreement, and that's the way it should be, and that's the way it's always has been. It's a verbal agreement. And if there is no verbal agreement, then there is no consent.
Dugan says he wanted to convict Cosby of 2 of the 3 charges he faced.
Guilty for lack of consent, not guilty that she was unconscious. And then guilty for the drugging.
But others in the room wanted to acquit Cosby of all 3 counts. He says it got emotional. He saw 4 jurors crying near the end of deliberations.
You know, people get more stressed, frustrated. They just want to go home, see their family, go back to their normal lives. And so, you know, I would say things got a little bit heated.
He wouldn't talk about the final vote count, and there have been conflicting reports. Some jurors who have spoken out said that it was 10-2 in favor of convicting Cosby of some of the charges. Other reports say the jury was evenly split. Either way, Dugan says hearing from the second Cosby accuser, Kelly Johnson, didn't bolster the prosecution's case, even though the additional accuser was seen by legal observers as a central witness.
We're there for Andrea Constan, not Kelly Johnson.
Dugan says it was frustrating to leave the case unresolved after 52 hours of deliberations. He says he's hoping the jury in Cosby's next trial will convict him. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
A look at the role of gerrymandering in determining 2016 election outcomes is the focus of an AP analysis. Joining me with takeaways from the study is AP journalist David A. Lieb. Mr. Lieb, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Glad to be here with you.
Why don't we start with the most basic? What is gerrymandering?
Well, gerrymandering traditionally is thought of as drawing legislative districts in really funny shapes to the advantage of one party or another. Gerrymandering does not necessarily have to involve oddly shaped districts, but it often does. Either way, the bottom line is to give one party an advantage based on the way the legislative districts are drawn.
And so, of course, these renderings are done based on the most recent census numbers, so we're talking about 2010 at this point.
That's correct. Based on the 2010 census, legislators in 2011 drew the maps that are now being used for U.S. Congress and state house elections in states across the country.
The AP analysis is based on the outcomes of all 435 U.S. House races and some 4,700 state house and assembly seats. I presume this kind of practice has undergone scrutiny before. What's different about this analysis?
So that's correct. The AP looked at the 2016 elections, and what the AP did is we applied a new statistical formula developed by a law professor at the University of Chicago and a researcher out at a public policy institute in California that takes a mathematical way of looking at the election results, comparing that to what would be expected, and using those figures to determine if there is a political advantage for the Republicans or Democrats. A sizable advantage could indicate that gerrymandering occurred.
And so what the term that's used in the study refers to as an efficiency gap.
An efficiency gap is essentially the difference between the amount of votes wasted by one party versus another. And that's a new word, too. So what this approach takes a look at is the percentage by which one party wins a seat compared to another. Now, there's wasted votes for both winners and losers in every election, and the goal is to waste as few votes as possible over the elections for all the districts.
Do these goals come up against the law?
Well, that's what's going to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. This new efficiency gap model was used in a Wisconsin gerrymandering case brought by Democratic voters alleging that the Republican General Assembly there gerrymandered the districts against Democrats back in 2010. A federal appeals court panel last fall ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, and they cited the efficiency gap as corroborating evidence, which marked one of the first times that a federal appellate court had ruled that partisan gerrymandering could cross the line between being just political to being unconstitutional. That case is now on appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which last week agreed to hear it, and it will be heard during the fall term.
What is the disparity in Pennsylvania?
So in Pennsylvania, the AP analysis found a 16.2% efficiency gap in favor of Republicans during the 2016 congressional elections. That ranked third highest nationally behind North Carolina and South Carolina.
We're focusing on GOP activities, but safe to say in states with Democratic majorities, be it New Jersey or, say, Maryland, the same tactics are widely being used?
That's correct. Gerrymandering is not something that's confined to the Republican Party. In 2016, it appeared more pronounced for the Republican Party because Republicans were in control of more states when district boundaries were redrawn after the 2010 census. But in states where Democrats controlled the process, where the Democrats controlled the legislature and the governor's office, the study shows that Democrats also enjoyed an advantage from that.
Mr. Lieb, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Well, glad to be present with you, and thanks for inviting me.
AP journalist David A. Lieb. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. In an occasional series, we answer listeners' questions about our region. And tonight, reporter Annette John Hall answers an inquiry posed by Alex Sheriffs of Philadelphia. Why is Pennsylvania called a commonwealth?
Four states in the nation, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Virginia, and Pennsylvania, use the designation commonwealth to define themselves. The distinction doesn't mean they're any different or enjoy any advantages over the other 46 states. It simply means they've adopted the British term for providing for the common good or the commonwealth of its citizens. The term was coined by 16th century English philosopher Thomas Hobbes, considered one of the founders of modern political theory. Given that Pennsylvania ranks as the worst state in educational inequality and among the worst in income inequality for African Americans and women, is the Commonwealth living up to its promise to provide for the good of all of its citizens?
I think we've established programs and policies that would advance the common good.
Christine Flowers is an immigration lawyer and opinion columnist. She says that aspirationally, Pennsylvania puts forth its best effort, but practically, there have been disappointments.
All you have to do is look around and Google trials in Pennsylvania, corruption trials in Pennsylvania. We have been let down by our politicians, our representatives, the people in whom we entrusted our welfare, our commonwealth.
Philadelphia Councilwoman at Large Helen Gim sees education as one of the most glaring disparities in providing for the commonwealth of all Pennsylvanians.
And a commonwealth like Pennsylvania, which is the worst in the nation when it comes to the funding gap between the poorest school districts and the wealthiest school districts, or when we see our young people graduate from college with some of the highest debt loads in the nation, we have to ask ourselves whether we are truly committed to that vision.
Gim says Pennsylvania is not living up to its name because it is not providing support for all of its citizens.
We're talking about what it means to care for our most vulnerable, for our youth who are experiencing homeless, for our mentally ill and those suffering from addiction. We're talking about supporting tenants who face eviction or immigrants facing deportation, that these are very important aspects of what it means to be part of an inclusive community.
Despite the challenges, Flowers is hopeful that all citizens will receive the common wealth that is their right.
I'm an optimist. I'm a cockeyed optimist. And I do believe that Pennsylvania, among all of the states and among the four commonwealths, really does have its eye on the prize being the future.
Annette John Hall, Keystone Crossroads.
This story was inspired by a question from a listener just like you. What are you curious about? Learn more and pose your questions for WHYY at newsworks.org. The Philadelphia Museum of Art now has opened an exhibition of wildlife photography by Michael Nichols, who for many years took pictures for National Geographic. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the show attempts to infuse high art with something genuinely wild.
The show, called Wild, features photographs of gorillas, tigers, lions, elephants in their natural habitat. I asked curator Peter Barberi how this kind of photojournalism fits in the context of art.
Well, it doesn't, does it? That's the short answer.
Barberi matched Michael Nichols' photographs with art objects from the museum's collection, like 19th century hunting paintings, pre-Columbian sculptures of animals, and a jungle scene by Henri Rousseau, a Parisian post-impressionist who never set foot in a jungle. The pairings of artwork with photojournalism suggests a long sweep of mankind's changing relationship with nature. Nichols spent his entire career hustling around the world, taking pictures that were meant to illustrate magazine stories with no intention of ever hanging them in a museum.
I didn't blink for 40 years. Maybe the reason I never printed my pictures, I never took the time to.
Nichols' photography requires a huge amount of technical resources and a fantastic amount of patience. He traveled to the most remote parts of the world hauling robots, infrared gear, computer monitors, drones, whatever it took to get as close as possible to an animal on its own turf. Then he would wait for weeks, sometimes months, to come away with a single picture of an animal acting completely in its nature, something wild, like tiger cubs at play or a lion eating the head of a zebra.
If you put the pieces there and you're patient enough, something special might happen. And that's what I was always after. I never wanted things to be so clean and tidy. I find that boring.
Nichols says he was always driven to tell stories, not to make art, and that's why it feels strange to him to be in the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
People don't see populist work like this too much in museums, and I'm a complete populist. But secretly in your heart, you want to be an artist, you want to be recognized, so this is really unbelievable for me, but at the same time, it's really good for the museum, too. Museums can get cloistered without even realizing it.
Wild stays at the Art Museum through the summer, and then it travels to National Geographic in Washington, D.C. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Planet hunting season has been extended this year. Let's train our telescopes with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, and truth be told, the season has been extended indefinitely.
Indeed it has. It's big game hunting for the Kepler spacecraft in our galaxy, at least anyway. It's looking among the stars of Cygnus, has been since 2009. And we've just looked at the last bit of data that was collected between 2009 and 2014. And the number of objects that Kepler has identified as potential candidates is now over 4,000. Of those 4,000, 2,335 are verified as planets, and that now includes another 219 that were just announced this week as actual, real exoplanets orbiting other stars.
So let's hone in a little further. How many of them are rocky, like planet Earth?
As it turns out, in this last bunch, 10 of them have been identified with a really cool word that I like as terrestrial. Terrestrial as opposed to Earth-like. Well, terrestrial means that these are rocky objects. These rocky objects are within the habitable zone of their star, which means they're at a distance from their star where water could exist as a liquid. And last but not least, they're near the size of the Earth. Now, we distinguish terrestrial from Earth-like because in this case, we're not talking about Earth twins and we're not talking about planets that seem to have atmospheres like Earth. We don't have that much information yet to make that sort of a stretch.
And of course, a true Earth twin would be the stuff of science fiction, though it is possible that there could be other forms of, dare we say, life on one of these terrestrial objects.
If we can find a big number of Earth-like planets that have atmospheres that are viable for life as we know it, then perhaps life could arise on one of those places too, and maybe even slightly different from what we see here. But we're so deep in the realm of speculation, it's hard to see our way back to the top.
Though with a confirmed sample size of now more than 2,300, do we know what percentage are terrestrial versus gas giant?
Well, interestingly enough, one of the things to come out of the most recent data gather is that the picture for the type of planets there are in the solar system divides neatly in half. 50% of those planets seem to be planets that are a little larger than Earth, like what we might call a super-Earth-type planet. And the other planets are planets that are more gaseous planets, up to the size of Neptune, like our Neptune in our solar system.
Smaller than Jupiter or Saturn.
Smaller than Jupiter or Saturn, yes, not that big, but not rocky like Earth either. So finding planets that are like Earth seems to be dwindling down. That chance seems to be dwindling. But at least the door is open to consider that that's a possibility.
Also dwindling down since we spoke last is, dare I say it, the amount of daylight.
Here we are, 1 week after the first day of summer, and we're already talking about the loss of daylight. Well, we're okay for right now, because for the week between the first day of the summer solstice and a date that's coming up very soon in early July, we're sort of hanging around now at the 15-hour mark. That's 15 hours of sunlight. Sunrise at 5:32 in the morning, sunset at 8:32 in the evening. But beginning next weekday, we'll start to lose minutes of daylight on the sunset end, and we'll start to lose minutes of daylight on the sunrise end. It'll start slowly at first with just a few seconds, and then it'll begin to ramp up. We'll begin to see the difference really in the sunsets coming a little earlier in about 2 weeks.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Thanks to our producers, Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thank you for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.